Okay, so mic check stuff. I need you to. We're friends here.
Right. Yeah, we can be nice and close. Yeah, and, there we go. Yeah, yeah, all right.
Isn't this how we used to do combinations?
Right. It was. I recall it being a very small, kind of sweaty room.
It's a very intimate environment. So if you could tell me what you had for breakfast this morning.
Today I actually didn't have anything for breakfast.
What'd you have for lunch?
I had a Chop House burger with fried egg. Ever since having fried eggs on burgers at the Rum Runner. Do you remember the Rum Runner?
I remember the Rum Runner.
Ever since having fried eggs there, I will always get a fried egg on my burger if I get a chance. And then because it was with these, I paid for it with these slips I was getting from the hotel since I wasn't having them clean my room. I got a $5 coupon to eat at their restaurant, and I got 6 of them. So I was like, so I got an order of key lime pie as well, and it was very good.
Very nice. Yeah. What is your earliest mathematical memory?
My earliest real mathematical memory comes from picking up the book Chaos and Fractals from the library, and it's this impressive tome. It's very long, but it's got very nice fractal pictures, and so. But it was also, it wasn't just the pictures. They had a lot of math in there, and it dealt with it from a sort of elementary level. But it was, you know, it was obviously far beyond what I could do at the time. But I very much enjoyed looking at the pictures anyway.
Okay, so we got you all leveled out here. So first thing I need: first name, last name, basic, you know, introductory.
Okay. Should I include my occupation as well?
Yeah, that's what I mean by basic.
Oh, right. Okay. My name is Cody Palmer. I'm a PhD candidate at the University of Montana in my final semester.
Yeah, so Cody will be probably graduated by the time you hear this. So another important thing to know about Cody is that we were grad students together at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas back in, when did you become a grad student?
2010, January of 2010.
Okay, so for a year and a half, three semesters, we were fellow grad students. And now I'm going to have Cody do something I always wanted him to do. I want Cody to spell his name.
My name is spelled CodyPalmer.
Okay, and so we are here to talk about vector-borne relapsing diseases. So what is a vector-borne relapsing disease?
So a vector-borne relapsing disease has A vector-borne relapsing disease has two main components. It's a disease that's...
Just it's on a vector and it's relapsing.
Yes. Yes. That's,
sorry. That, I'm actually going to play this like a fun interview. Okay. I never get to do them.
Yeah, sure.
Because we know each other and we've done this. Yeah. But I don't have Wikipedia in front of me, so I feel like I'm going to step on everything. Like, I really want to mute you.
Sure.
But
sure.
The only person.
Sure. So it's a vector-borne relapsing disease. And so when we say vector, we don't mean it in the linear algebra sense. We mean it in the epidemiological sense. A vector is some agent that's carrying the disease among a host population. And the relapsing portion is that it's just a disease that you can apparently get over, but then you get it again without coming into contact with any other infected hosts or vectors.
And so that's great. I literally, until I saw your talk, I had no idea that there were diseases, that there were like a multitude of diseases like that. I've known cases where it happens, but I didn't know of like this class of disease. And so could you tell me a little bit about the specific one that you were working with?
Yeah, so I'm working, the main motivation for the model that I'm working on is tick-borne relapsing fever. And so this is a fever that's spread by small ticks, not deer ticks like what you would get hiking around, but small ticks that live in rodent nests and mattresses in sort of rustic cabins. And it's a fever that you get, you have it for about a week or so, and then you relapse, or then you don't have it, and then you relapse and you get it again, and that'll happen 3 to 4 times. However, the relapsing fever isn't necessarily spread by just ticks. It can be spread by lice as well. In fact, during both of the world wars, there were pretty significant epidemics of relapsing fever among the troops. And actually, it's so distinctive in its character that you can read clinical descriptions of relapsing fever dating back to the ancient Greeks.
Oh, wow. That's actually absolutely fascinating. Yeah. You surprised me. So what you guys can't see out there in podcast land is that Cody Palmer has this glorious, massively huge beard. So I'm wondering, since you look like you live in a rustic cabin, is there a very personal motivation for this, Cody?
I have not had relapsing fever.
I don't believe you.
I have thought about it because there's actually it's interesting. What motivated it for us in particular is just north of where I live in Missoula. There's this giant flathead lake that has an island on it where I think it's Boy Scouts or some other youth groups go up there and stay there. And then there was a couple people that after staying on this island had gotten relapsing fever. And so there's this island in a lake where we know that the ticks have. Are carrying this relapsing fever. So I've thought about going up there and kind of just, I don't know, laying naked in the brush to see if I could pick this up just to experience it.
You were that Boy Scout. I know you were that Boy Scout. You can deny it all you want. You were that Boy Scout. So it's a specific type of bacteria. We can stop joking around and go into the actual biology. So it's a very specific type of bacteria. So can you tell me a little bit about the bacterium?
Yeah. So it's a Borrelia bacteria, which is actually a spiral bacteria, and it's carried in the tick's saliva glands, and it's a version of Borrelia with the lice too. It has various different kinds that can be spread. Among humans and rodents as well. What's curious about the Borrelia, or really interesting about the Borrelia, is that on its surface it has these structures that epidemiologists and disease modelers call antigenic structures. And these are just particular arrangements of proteins and other things that the host's immune system can identify, and the antibodies of the host will bind onto these antigenic structures. There's a match between the structure, a complementary match between the structure of the antibody and the antigenic structure, and they can bind together, and that's how the immune system of the host can identify the bacteria. Well, Borrelia is special because it can actually, over its reproductions, it can actually change its antigenic structures. So all of a sudden it becomes unrecognizable to the host's immune system.
And so that is kind of the agent of relapse in this case.
Right. That's exactly what causes the relapse. And again, the mechanisms that actually drive that are very complicated. You could probably spend a whole year or two trying to learn what actually drives these mechanisms.
So then you built a model to kind of, well, I mean, can you tell me a little bit about the motivations behind, the mathematical motivations behind building a model for this relapsing fever?
So this model actually wasn't constructed by me. It was actually constructed by a computational ecologist, Erin Langeth, at the University of Montana. And she had actually, just sort of a side story, she had actually split her PhD thesis into two parts where she had constructed this model and maybe done some numerics on it, but had really just constructed it. And then she had also constructed a model that was modeling the movement of bears through mountain ranges.
You were that bear.
Yeah, maybe, I don't know. However, she ended up really making her money with her moving bear model. People were much more interested in that. And so my advisor, who had overseen her thesis, sort of handed me this project and said, okay, let's start to do some real math on this. Not to say that computational ecologists don't do real math, but she hadn't done any of sort of the classic disease modeling analysis. And so, the motivation was pretty simple. There are lots in disease modeling. There's a nice basis for building models. We can sort of draw our pictures and pictures of compartments and movement, and it's all pretty standard. It was really just about sort of assembling the puzzle pieces into this model.
And so you mentioned kind of the traditional disease modeling mathematics that you do. So what is that? So what are those things that you would, once you have the model, usually do?
Oh, so a lot of it comes from the work of Kermack and McKendrick back in the 1920s when they were first trying to model the spread of various diseases. And even before them, there was a, I think it was a biologist by the name of Ross, who was trying to prove that if you started killing off mosquitoes, you could actually get rid of malaria by killing off the mosquitoes, which seems obvious to us now. But a lot of these methods are inspired by them, and so you take their equations. Really, where our model comes from is we take their equations and we modify them.
What are those equations trying to show?
Oh, so those equations are really trying to show, I guess maybe a clarification on that. What's the, like, further question?
Well, they are equations and it is a disease model, but with any sort of modeling, it's usually there's some sort of end goal, like you're trying to understand something. I'm just wondering what it is that you are trying to understand by using those equations.
Oh, right. Okay, sorry. So our main goal was to try and learn about how the number of relapses actually affects the disease. So it was sort of this question that, it was a nice theoretical question of like, okay, is there maybe like a critical number of relapses where, the dynamics change for whatever reason? We weren't sure. And so we were really sitting down with these equations to try and figure out how the spread of the disease, how infective the disease is, depends on the number of relapses.
And so, as you said, this usually is a 3 or 4 relapse disease about or so, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. And so your model did not just make it 3 or 4. So you were actually testing for a lot of different numbers of relapses. And so what essentially did you end up finding from that?
Well, we found sort of disappointingly, we found that the dynamics don't change no matter how many relapses there are. When I say they don't change, I mean in a broad qualitative sense, really nothing super special starts happening as we add relapses. Although the one thing that we did note is that the disease, and maybe this is sort of common sense, what you would expect to happen is that the more relapses that you add into a disease, sort of the more average number of infections you're going to get from a single infected individual.
Yeah. I mean, the longer you have the disease, that's about expected behavior. So let's see, other notes that I have. You did something with latency.
Right. So in our model, we sort of considered like you're in one infected state and then you move immediately into another infected state. And in both of these states have in common is that if a tick bites you in these infected states, if the tick doesn't have the disease, it could get the disease. However, that's sort of a simple beginning to the model. But in reality, there's about a week between relapses where your body actually gets rid of virtually all of this Borrelia bacteria. And this is another interesting side note. For this tick-borne relapsing fever, it's enough for you to get one of these bacteria in your system to initiate a total body infection. And so your body can reduce it down to, almost nothing. And so if a tick bites you in that stage between your fevers, that tick is not going to get the disease if he doesn't already have it. So we altered our model then to consider a case where there's a compartment between infected compartments where you're infected, but you're not infecting any of the ticks or any of the vectors.
I just realized we actually skipped over the model itself.
So let's
track back to that. So you just mentioned compartments. So like, it kind of, what was an outline of how you or how this model actually was constructed?
So with compartmental models, we start with a picture, which is kind of nice. It's always good to start with a picture, and you can take a population of hosts and a population of vectors, and you can split them up into different compartments. So for example, in a host or in a standard disease model, what we call an SIR model, we call it that because it has three compartments. We have susceptible, us, those who can get infected, infected, those who are infected, and recovered, those who have been infected and recovered and can't get the disease again. However, we expanded that into sort of an IR model, where you have susceptible hosts, and then you have infected in the first version of the disease, infected in the second one, and so you move through all these compartments. And then with the vectors, because the immune system of the vectors is generally not attacking the disease, it never really relapses. So you really just have susceptible vectors, those who don't have the disease, and infected vectors, those who do have it.
So this was a weird thing that just popped into my head. So you were talking about the Borrelia disease, and essentially it's different shapes. Like that's how it ends up relapsing. So somehow the Borrelia essentially just seems to have so many shapes, and it kind of must like circle back, and then it just all gets killed off. So I was wondering, since the ticks, ticks can get it when they bite someone else. So say you have a tick who bites a person, gives it some initial version of the bacteria, say bacteria shape A. Mm-hmm. And then the next time so it gets over that. And so when it's in its kind of the in-between mm-hmm. section, what happens, and so it's about to have bacteria shape B, mm-hmm. but there's bacteria shape C and D as well. So what happens if it then gets bit by a tick that has bacteria shape C in it, and so it's then infected by both shape B and shape C at the same time? Mm-hmm. Does it just get over it kind of quicker because all of a sudden it's battling both of those, and those probably aren't going to make you double sick?
Yeah. Well, that's sort of one hypothesis that you could come up with why there's variation among the number of relapses. Again, in tick-borne relapsing fever, there's 3 to 4, right? There's some randomness in there, and at least in none of the literature I've read, there's not a lot of descriptions about how having multiple strains or multiple types of Borrelia with different antigenic structures affects the spread of the disease in the host.
So apparently this is what happens when I'm actually at a math conference for a while. I start to think up actual questions. It's,
right.
I need to get this out of my brain. I need to think up dumb questions. So once you had that, were there any sort of conclusions that you ended up coming up with from the model, like after you were, you know, done doing your analyses on it?
So it's worth mentioning, first of all, that while the analyses were standard, they were very difficult because we were dealing with an arbitrary number of equations. So this involved, like a lot of the computations that we did, involved taking an inverse of a matrix of arbitrary size and then multiplying together matrices of arbitrary size and then finding an eigenvalue of a matrix of arbitrary size, and then proving that 0 was an eigenvalue for a matrix of arbitrary size, and it was simple. So it was a lot of sort of very difficult calculations to do, but we managed to prove a couple of things. So first of all, we proved a form for this parameter that's called R0. That's very common in disease and ecological modeling, and it's just defined in disease as the average number of infections produced by a single infected individual. So we managed to come up with a form for that that depended on the number.
That is very loud.
Yeah. So we managed to show that there was a form for this prove that there was a form for this R0 that depended on the number of relapses, which that was one of the main things we were going for, to see how the spread of the disease depended on the number of relapses, to quantify that exactly. We also proved the existence of what are called endemic equilibria. And so these are going to be steady states of the system that where some portion of the susceptible population is infected. So not everybody is getting infected, but some of them are getting infected, and that's sort of where the disease levels out. It doesn't infect everybody, but it'll just sort of level out at this endemic equilibrium.
So there's a case where it just won't go away. Like there's just like enough of it to maintain itself, but not enough to go to be an epidemic.
Yeah, and one of the things that we managed to show is that when this R-naught parameter is larger than one, we have these endemic equilibria that where the disease will persist in the population for as long as the population exists.
Is there something that I should have asked you about this, but I didn't because, you know, I'm not actually that smart, and so I don't always have all the right questions? How about this? Think about it for 30 seconds. I'm going to gather room tone.
Okay. So in this system, these endemic equilibria, one of the things that we worked very hard at was to prove something about their stability. And what we ended up proving was that when the number of infected individuals or the number of new infections produced by a single infected individual, when that's close to one, these endemic equilibria are stable. And so what'll happen is that if there's a little bit of the disease in the population, instead of it dying out, it will actually tend towards these endemic equilibriums. So depending on what the value of R-naught is in your population, it could be if you get it even in just one individual in the population, it's going to turn endemic, that it's always going to be there. However, what's interesting about that is that I said that that's only true when the average number of new infections from an infected individual is near one. Once it gets greater than one, we're not actually sure what happens. The math becomes a little hard to do in those cases to try and assess their stability.
So I guess the question is, like, I mean, Are we just in an endemic state now, so we can kind of think that it'll just stay low, or I mean, because if it is actually greater than one, then all of a sudden the ticks go everywhere. Is this something I have to worry about?
So there's actually, in North America, there's very little data known about this disease because it's not very prevalent at all. In fact, the most recent sort of collection of data and study I was able to find was from the late 1940s. However, it is beginning to reemerge in the third world, whether it's spread by ticks or lice. And one of the main things about these relapsing fevers in the third world is that it'll often get misdiagnosed as malaria. Now, it's not a particularly fatal disease, so even if you do get it, you probably don't have to worry about it. But I think for people in the third world, in rural areas where they don't have access to immediate treatment, if this kind of disease gets misidentified as malaria, it's not going to be treated correctly. And it could result in, and again, I think untreated, the death rate is around 10%, 10 to 15%, which is maybe more, well, it's definitely more than you want.
And is there any way that the work that you've done so far might be able to be spun up so that anything else could be known so that we could do a better job with this?
If it's no, that's fine.
Yeah, I wish I could say yes, but I don't think so. No. In general, a lot of our results tend to be sort of observational about the disease, just saying, okay, well, in a relapsing disease, here's what we can expect to happen. You can look at the disease and you can... Well, I guess maybe let me revise my previous statement. Yes, based on the work that we've done, you can sort of see that there are some really good common sense approaches that you can take. So, for example, if you can reduce the biting rate, so if you can sort of avoid interactions with these infected vectors, obviously, you can drive the disease out of the population. That's enough. Other things like, you know, extermination is something that can drive the disease out of the population. And, you know, as far as other medical procedures that can be done, I'm not entirely sure. That's a little out of my depth, because there are issues of maybe there are things that you can do that make it harder for the disease to get a foothold in your system. I'm not really sure.
And so when you're doing these sort of observational things, is the basic idea just to, I mean, help from a general like public health standpoint, so that the people in charge of public health, if they know that these observational studies are out there and something does come into the population, that they can now have a basic instinct for what might happen?
Yeah, it would give them, I think that if they looked at the study and they looked at our conclusions, it would give them sort of a...
The siren? Yeah, I can hear it through a mic.
Oh, okay.
And that's impossible to edit around.
Oh, sure.
Especially because it Dopplers. And so if you, like, if it's still in, like, if you can edit to a point where it's just gone, mm-hmm. that's fine. Because then it's just like, oh, they just went away. Mm-hmm. But if you edit from a point where it's loud to a point where it's Dopplered away, mm-hmm. then it's like, nope, that's a clear edit point.
No.
Yeah, the weird things you learn when you start doing
it. Right.
Sorry, I probably have to start from the beginning again. Public health.
Yeah. So I sort of the main conclusions that a public health official or public health public health administration could take from this would be sort of the common sense measures to eliminate the disease from population. And you could look at some of the, if you wanted to do some number crunching, you could probably devise some treatment strategies. You know, what's the smartest relapse to treat at, and things like that. You could probably do something like that. Yeah.
Well, Cody, thank you so much for sitting down with me.
Thanks for having me.